The lecturer had been giving us a talk about electricity and he said, "Now, I will give you a practical demonstration of the effects of electricity, a harmless demonstration." He handed me two wires and said, "Hold these, will you, hold them tightly until I say, let go." I thought that he was asking me to assist him in his demonstration. He was, and so I held the wires, although I was rather perturbed because his aura showed that he was contemplating some form of treachery. I thought, well, perhaps I am misjudging him. He's not a very nice fellow anyhow. He turned and walked quickly away from me to his own demonstration table. There he pressed a switch. I saw light coming from the wire and I saw the aura of the lecturer betray amazement. He appeared to be intensely surprised. "Hold them tighter," he said. So I did. I squeezed the wires. The lecturer looked at me and really rubbed his eyes. He was astounded. That was obvious to everyone, even anyone without the ability to see the aura. It was obvious that this lecturer had never had such a surprise before. The other students looked on in open-mouthed wonder. They could not understand what it was all about. They had no idea at all what was intended. Quickly the lecturer came back to me after switching off and took the two wires from me. He said, "There must be something wrong, there must be a disconnection." He took the two wires in his hand and went back to the table with them. One wire was in his left hand, the other was in his right. Still holding them, he stretched forth a finger and flicked on the switch. Then he erupted into a tremendous yowl. "Switch off, it's killing me." At the same time his body was knotted up as if all his muscles were tied and paralyzed. He continued to yell and scream and his aura looked like the setting sun. "How very interesting," I thought. "I have never seen anything as pretty as that in the human aura." The continued shrieks of the lecturer soon brought people running in. One man took a glance at him and rushed to the table and switched off the switch. The poor lecturer dropped to the floor, perspiring freely and shaking. He looked a sorry sight. His face had a pale greenish tinge to it. Eventually he stood up, clasping the edge of the desk. "You did that to me," I replied. "I? I haven't done a thing. You told me to hold the wires and I held them, then you took them from me and you looked as if you were going to die." He said, "I can't understand it. I can't understand it." I answered, "What can't you understand? I held the things, what are you talking about?" He looked at me. "Didn't you really feel anything? Didn't you feel a tingle or anything?" "Well," I said, "I felt just a pleasant bit of warmth, nothing more. Why, what should I feel?" Another lecturer, the one who had switched off the current, said, "Will you try it again?" I said, "Of course I will, as many times as you like." So he handed me the wires. He said, "Now I am going to switch on. Tell me what happens." He pressed the switch, and I said, "Oh, it's just a pleasant bit of warmth. Nothing to worry about at all. It's just as if I had my hands fairly close to a fire." He said, "Squeeze it tighter." And I did so. I actually squeezed it until the muscles stood out on the backs of my hands. He and the previous lecturer looked at each other, and the current was switched off. Then one of them took the two wires from me and put cloth around them, and he held them lightly in his hands. "Switch on," he said to the other. So the other lecturer switched on, and the man with the wires wrapped in cloth in his hands soon dropped it. He said, "Oh, it's still on." In dropping, the two wires fell free of the cloth and touched. There was a vivid blue flash, and a lump of molten metal jumped from the end of the wire. "Now you have blown the fuses," said one, and he went off to do a repair somewhere. With the current restored, they went on with their lecture about electricity. They said they were trying to give me 250 volts as a shock to show what electricity could do. I have a peculiarly dry skin and 250 volts hurt me not at all. I can put my hands on the mains and be quite unaware of whether they are on or not. The poor lecturer was not of that type at all. He was remarkably susceptible to electric currents. In the course of the lecture they said, "In America, if a man commits murder, or if the lawyers say that he is guilty of murder, the man is killed by electricity. He is strapped to a chair, and the current is applied to his body and it kills him." I thought, how very interesting. I wonder what they would do with me, though I have no desire to try it seriously. Chapter 3 Medical Days. A dank, grey fog came down from the hills above Chongqing, blotting out the houses, the river, the masts of the ships down below, turning the lights in the shops to orange-yellow blurs, deadening the sounds, perhaps even improving the appearance of part of Chongqing. There was the slithering sound of footsteps and a bent old man came dimly into sight through the fog, and was as quickly lost to view again. It was strangely silent here, the only sounds were muffled sounds. The fog was as a thick blanket deadening all. Huang and I had finished our classes for the day and it was now late evening. We had decided to go out from the college, from the dissecting rooms, and get a breath of fresh air. Instead we had got this fog. I was feeling hungry, apparently so was Huang. The dampness had got into our bones and chilled us. Let us go and have some food, Lobsang. I know a good place, said Huang. All right, I answered. I am always ready for something interesting. What have you got to show me? Oh, I want to show you that we in Chongqing can live quite well in spite of what you say. He turned and led the way, or rather he turned and groped blindly till we reached the side of the street and were able to identify the shops. We went down a hill a little way and then through an entrance which appeared to be remarkably like a cavern in the side of a mountain. Inside the air was even thicker than outside. People were smoking, belching great clouds of evil-smelling fumes. It was almost the first time I had seen such a number of people smoking. It was quite a novelty, a nauseating one, to see people with burning brands in their mouth, and smoke trickling out of their nostrils. One man attracted my fascinated gaze. He was producing smoke not just from his nostrils, but from his ears. I pointed him out to Huang. Oh, him, he said. He's stone deaf, you know. Had his eardrums kicked in. It's quite a social asset with him. No eardrums to impede the smoke, so he sends it out of his nostrils and out of his ears too. He goes up to a foreigner and says, give me a cigarette and I'll show you something you can't do. Keeps him in smokes, that. Still that's nothing. Let's get on with the food. I'll order the meal, said Huang. I am well known here and we shall get the best at the lowest price. It suited me fine. I had not eaten too well during the past few days, everything was so strange, and the food so utterly alien. Huang spoke to one of the waiters who made notes on a little pad, and then we sat down and talked. Food had been one of my problems. I could not obtain the type of food to which I was accustomed, and I had to eat, among other things, flesh and fish. To me, as a Lama of Tibet, this was truly revolting, but I had been told by my seniors at the Potala in Lhasa that I would have to accustom myself to alien foods, and I had been given absolution from them for the type of food I should consume. In Tibet we, the priests, ate no meat but, this was not Tibet, and I had to continue to live in order to fulfill my allotted task. It was possible to obtain the food I wanted, and so I had to eat the revolting messes brought me and pretend that I liked them. Our lunch arrived. A half-tortoise surrounded with sea slugs, and followed by a dish of curried frogs with cabbage leaves around them. They were quite pleasant but I would have much preferred my own tsampa. So, making the best of things, I had my meal of curried frogs well supported with noodles and rice. We drank tea. One thing I have never touched in spite of all exhortations from those outside of Tibet have been intoxicating liquors. Never, never, never. In our belief there is nothing worse than these intoxicating drinks, nothing worse than drunkenness. Drunkenness, we consider, is the most vicious sin of all because when the body is sodden with drink the astral vehicle, the more spiritual part of one, is driven out of the physical and has to leave it as prey to any prowling entities. This is not the only life, the physical body is just one particular manifestation, the lowest manifestation, and the more one drinks, the more one harms one's body in other planes of existence. It is well known that drunkards see pink elephants and curious things which have no parallel in the physical world. These, we believe, are the manifestations of some evil entity. Some entity who is trying to make the physical body do some harm. It is well known that those who are drunk are not in possession of their right senses. So, I have not at any time touched intoxicating drinks, not even corn spirit, not even rice wine. Lacquered duck is a very nice form of food, for those who like meat, that is. I much preferred bamboo shoots, these are unobtainable in the West, of course. The nearest substitute to it is a form of celery which grows in a certain European country. The English celery is quite different and is not so suitable. While discussing Chinese food, it is possibly of some interest to say that there is no such dish as chop suey, that is just a name, a generic name for Chinese food, any Chinese food. If anyone wants a really good Chinese meal, they should go to a first-class all-Chinese restaurant and have ragu of mushroom and bamboo shoot. Then they should take a fish soup. After that, lacquered duck. You will not have a carving knife in the real Chinese restaurant. But the waiter will come along with a small hatchet and he will chop up the duck for you into suitably sized slices. When these are approved by you, they will be wrapped up with a piece of young onion into a sandwich of unleavened bread. One picks up these small sandwiches and devours each at a mouthful. The meal should end with lotus leaves, or, if you prefer, lotus root. Some people prefer lotus seed, but whichever it is, you will need adequate quantities of Chinese tea. This is the type of meal we had in that eating house so well known to Huang. The price was surprisingly reasonable, and when eventually we rose to continue our journey, we were in quite a blissful state of geniality, well padded, and well fortified with good food to go out again and face the fog. So, we made our way up the street, along the road to Qialing, and when we were part way along that road, we turned right into the path leading up to our temple. It was service time when we got back. The tablets were hanging limply against their poles. There was no breeze, and the clouds of incense were just hanging motionless too. The tablets are of red material with gold Chinese ideographs upon them. They were the tablets of the ancestors and were used in much the same way as tombstones are used to commemorate the dead in Western countries. We bowed to Ho Tian Quan Yin, the god of good living and the goddess of compassion, and went our way into the dimly lit interior of the temple for our service. After which we were unable to face our evening meal, but instead rolled ourselves into our blankets and drifted off to sleep. There was never any shortage of bodies for dissection. Bodies in Chongqing at that time were a very easily obtained commodity. Later, when the war started, we were to have more corpses than we could deal with. But these which were obtained for dissection, we kept in an underground room which was carefully cooled. As soon as we could obtain a fresh body from the streets, or from a hospital, we used to inject into the groin a most powerful disinfectant that served to preserve the body for some months. It was quite interesting to go down into the basement and see the bodies on slabs, and to notice how invariably they were thin bodies. We used to have quite heated disputes as to which of us should have the thinnest. The fat bodies were a great trouble in dissecting, there was so much labor with so little result. One could go on cutting and cutting, dissecting out a nerve or an artery and have to dissect away layer after layer of fatty tissues. Bodies were not in short supply at all. Frequently we had so many on hand that we kept them in danks, in pickle, as we called it. Of course, it was not always easy to smuggle a body into the hospital because some of the relatives had strong opinions about such things. In those days, young babies who had died were abandoned in the streets, or those adults whose families were too poor to pay for a satisfactory funeral left them out in the streets under cover of darkness. We medical students, then, frequently went out in the early morning to pick the best-looking bodies, and, of course, the leanest. We could have had a whole body to ourselves. Often we work two to a cadaver, one doing the head, the other doing the feet. That was more companionable. Quite frequently we had our lunch in the dissecting room if we were studying for some examination. It was no uncommon thing to see a student with his food spread out on the stomach of a cadaver while his textbook, which he was reading, would be propped up against the thigh. It never occurred to us at that time that we could obtain all sorts of curious complaints through infection from dead bodies. Our principal, Dr. Lee, had all the latest American ideas, In some ways he was almost a crank for copying the Americans, but no matter. He was a good man, one of the most brilliant Chinamen that I have met, and it was a pleasure to study with him. I learned a lot and passed many examinations, but I still maintain that I learned far more morbid anatomy from the body breakers of Tibet. Our college and the attached hospital were at the far end of the road away from the docks along from the street steps. In fine weather we had quite a good view across the river, across the terraced fields, because it was in a very prominent position, a prominent landmark, in fact. Toward the harbor in the more business section of the street was an old shop looking as if it were in the last stages of decay. The woodwork appeared to be worm-eaten, and the paint was flaking from the boards. The door was ramshackle and rickety. Above it there was a cut-out wooden figure of a gaudily painted tiger. It was so arranged that it arched its back over the entrance. Yawning jowls with ferocious-looking teeth and claws which were realistic enough to strike terror into anyone's heart. This tiger was meant to show virility. It is an old Chinese emblem for virility. This shop was a beacon for run-down men, and for those who wished to have greater vigor with which to pursue their amusements. Women, too, went here to get certain compounds, extract of tiger, or extract of ginseng root, when they wanted to have children and for some reason apparently could not. Extract of tiger or extract of ginseng contained large quantities of substance which help men and women in such difficult times, substances which have only recently been discovered by Western science who hail it as a great triumph of commerce and research. The Chinese and the Tibetans did not know so much about modern research, and so they have had those compounds for 3 or 4 thousand years and have not boasted unduly about it. It is a fact that the West could learn so much from the East if the West was more cooperative. But, to turn to this old shop with its fierce tiger carved and painted above it, with a window full of strange-looking powders, mummies and bottles of colored liquids. This was the shop of an old-style medical practitioner where it was possible to obtain powdered toad, the horns of antelope ground to powder to act as an aphrodisiac, and other strange concoctions. Not often in these poorer quarters did the patient go to the modern surgery of the hospital for treatment. Instead, he went to this dirty old shop in much the same way as his father had done, and perhaps as his father's father before had done also. He took his complaints to the physician in charge, who sat looking like an owl with powerful lensed spectacles behind a brown wooden barrier. He would discuss his case and the symptoms, and the old physician would solemnly nod his head and with fingertips touching he would ponderously prescribe the necessary medicine. One convention was that the medicine had to be colored according to a special code. That was an unwritten law from time before history. For a stomach complaint the medicine provided would be yellow, while the patient suffering from a blood or a heart disease would have red medicine. Those afflicted with bile or liver complaints or even with excessively bad temper would have a green medicine. Patients who were suffering from eye troubles would have blue lotion. The interior of a person presented great problems regarding which color to use. If a person had a pain inside and it was thought to be of intestinal origin, the medicine would be brown. An expectant mother had only, so she was told, to take the pulverized flesh of a turtle and the baby would be born painlessly, easily, almost before she was aware of it, and so her day's work would not be interfered with. One injunction was go home, put an apron around you, between your legs, so that the baby shall not drop and strike the ground, and then swallow this pulverized flesh of a turtle. The old, unregistered Chinese doctor could advertise, and this he did in a most spectacular manner. Usually he had a large sign, an immense painted sign above his house, to show what a wonderful healer he was. Not only that, but in his waiting room and surgery would be found great medals and shields which wealthy and frightened patients had given him to testify to the miraculous way in which he, with colored medicines, powders and potions, had cured them of unknown and unspecified diseases. The poor dentist was not so lucky, the older style dentist. That is, most of the time he had no particular house in which to see patients, but he saw them in the street. The victim sat down on a box and the dentist carried out his examination, his poking and probing, in full view of an appreciative audience. Then, with a lot of strange maneuvers and gesticulations, he would proceed to extract the faulty tooth. Proceed is the right term because if the patient was frightened or excessively noisy, it was not always easy to do an extraction, and at times the dentist would not hesitate to call upon bystanders to hold the struggling victim. There was no anesthetic used. The dentist did not advertise as the doctors did with signs and shields and medals, but instead around his neck he wore strings of teeth which he had extracted. Whenever he had extracted a tooth, that tooth would be picked up, carefully cleaned, and a hole drilled through it. It would then be threaded onto a string to add one more testimony to the skill of the dentist who had pulled so many. It used to annoy us considerably when patients on whom we had lavished much time and care, and to whom we had given the very latest treatment and prescribed expensive drugs, crept surreptitiously into the back entrance of the old Chinese doctor's premises for treatment by him. We claimed that we cured the patient. The quack claimed that he cured. But the patient said nothing, he was too glad to be free of his ill. As we became more and more advanced in our studies and walked the wards of the hospital, we had on frequent occasions to go out with a full qualified doctor to treat people in their own homes, to assist at operations. Sometimes we had to descend the cliffs to inaccessible places, perhaps to some place where some poor unfortunate had fallen over and shattered bones or lacerated flesh almost beyond repair. We had visits to those who had floating homes upon the rivers. In the Kialing River there are people who live on houseboats, or even rafts of bamboo covered with matting on which they erect little huts. These swayed and bobbed at the bank of the river, and, unless we were careful, particularly at night, it was remarkably easy to miss one's footing or to stand firmly upon a loose piece of bamboo which merely sank beneath one. Then one was not at all cheered by the laughter of the inevitable crowd of small boys who always gathered on such unfortunate occasions. The old Chinese peasants were able to put up with an amazing amount of pain. They never complained and they were always grateful for what we could do for them. We used to go out of our way to help the old people, perhaps help to clean up their little hut, or prepare food for them. But with the younger generation things were not so pleasant. They were getting restive, they were getting strange ideas. The men from Moscow were circulating among them, preparing them for the advent of communism. We knew it, but there was nothing we could do except to stand by and watch helplessly. But before we became so qualified we had an enormous amount of study to do. Study a whole diversity of subjects for as long as 14 hours a day. Magnetism as well as electricity, to quote just two. I well remember the first lecture I attended on magnetism. Then it was a subject almost entirely unknown to me. It was perhaps as interesting in its way as that which I attended on electricity. The lecturer was not really a very pleasant individual, but here is what happened. Huang had pushed his way through the crowd to read notices on the board to see where we should go for the next class. He started reading, then, Hoi, Lobsang, he called across to me, we've got a lecture on magnetism this afternoon. We were glad to see that we were in the same class because we had formed a very sincere friendship. We walked out into the quadrangle, across and into a classroom next door to that devoted to electricity. We entered. Inside there was a lot of equipment much the same, it seemed to us, as that dealing with electricity proper. Coils of wire, strange pieces of metal bent roughly to a horseshoe shape. Black rods, glass rods, and various glass boxes containing what looked like water, and bits of wooden lead. We took our places and the lecturer came in and stalked ponderously to his table. He was a heavy man, heavy in body, heavy in mind. Certainly he had a very good opinion of his own abilities, a far greater opinion of his abilities than his colleagues had of them. He too had been to America, and whereas some of the others of the tutorial staff had returned knowing how little they really knew, this one was utterly convinced that he knew everything, that his own brain was infallible. He took his place and for some reason picked up a wooden hammer and rapped violently on his desk. Silence. He roared. Although there had not been a sound. We are going to do magnetism, the first lecture for some of you on this absorbing subject, he said. He picked up one of the bars bent in the shape of a horseshoe. This, he said, as a field around it. I immediately thought of grazing horses. He said, I am going to show you how to outline the field of the magnet with iron dust. Magnetism, he went on, will activate each particle of this iron, which will then draw for itself the exact outline of the force which motivates it. I incautiously remarked to Huang, who was sitting behind me, but any fool can see it now, why tamper with it? The lecturer jumped up in a furious temper. Oh, he said, the great Lama from Tibet, who doesn't know the first thing about magnetism or electricity, can see a magnetic field, can he? He stabbed a finger violently in my direction. So, great Lama, you can see this wonderful field, can you? The only man in existence who can, perhaps, he said sneeringly. I stood up. Yes, honorable lecturer, I can see it very clearly, I said. I can also see the lights around those wires. He took his wooden hammer again, brought it down with a succession of resounding crashes on his desk. You lie, he said, no one can see it. If you are so clever, come and draw it for me, and then we will see what sort of a mess you make of it. I sighed wearily as I went up to him, picked up the magnet and went to the blackboard with a piece of chalk. The magnet I put flat on the board, then I drew around it the exact shape of the bluish light which I could see coming from the magnet. I drew, also, those lighter striations which were within the field itself. It was such a simple matter for me. I had been born with the ability, and I had had the ability increased in me by operations. There was absolutely dead silence when I had finished, and I turned round. The lecturer was watching me, and his eyes were quite literally bulging. You've studied this before, he said, it's a trick. Honorable lecturer, I replied, until this day I have never seen one of these magnets. He said, well, I do not know how you do it, but that is the correct field. I still maintain that it is a trick. I still maintain that in Tibet you learned only trickery. I do not understand it. He took the magnet from me, covered it with a sheet of thin paper, and onto the paper he sprinkled fine iron dust. With a finger he tapped on the paper and the dust took up the exact shape of that which I had drawn on the blackboard. He looked at it, he looked at my drawing, and he looked back at the outline in the iron filings. I still do not believe you, man from Tibet, he said. I still think that it is a trick. He sat down wearily and propped his head in his hands, then with explosive violence, he jumped up and shot out his hand to me again. You, he said, you said that you could see the field of that magnet. You also said, and I can see the light around those wires. That is so, I replied, I can. I can see them easily. Right. He shouted at me, now we can prove you wrong, prove you are a fake. He wheeled round, knocking over his chair in his temper. He hurried to a corner, bent down with a grunt, picked up a box, with wires protruding in a coil from the top. He stood up and placed it on the table in front of me. Now, he said, now, here is a very interesting box known as a high-frequency box. You draw the field of that for me and I will believe in you. There you are, you draw that field. He looked at me as if to say, I'll dare you to. I said, all right. It's simple enough. Let us put it nearer the blackboard, otherwise I shall be doing it by memory. He picked up one end of the table and I picked up the other and we moved it right up close to the blackboard. I took the chalk in my hand, and turned away to the board. Oh, I said, it's all gone. I looked in amazement because there were just wires, nothing else, no field. I turned towards him, his hand was on a switch. He had switched off the current, but there was a look of absolute stupefaction on his face. So, he said, you really can see that. Well, well, how remarkable. He switched on again and said, turn away from me and tell me when it is on and when it is off. I turned away from him and I was able to tell him, off, on, off. He left it off then and sat in his chair in the attitude of a man whose faith has received a crushing blow. Then, abruptly, he said, class dismissed. Turning to me, not you. I want to speak to you alone. The others muttered with resentment. They had come for a lecture and they had found some interest. Why should they be turned out now? He just shooed them out, taking one or two by the shoulders to hustle them more quickly. The lecturer's word was law. With the classroom emptied, he said, "Now, tell me more of this. What sort of trick is it?" I said, "It is not a trick. It is a faculty with which I was born and which was strengthened by a special operation. I can see auras. I can see your aura."